Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, James Farmer and the science behind the success of local food systems. On Tuesday, September 16th, Science Cafe presented James Farmer, an assistant professor in the SPIA School. Farmer is an expert in local food and the dynamics of farmers markets and restaurants. His presentation centered on the value of decentralized food distribution. This event was hosted by Finch's Brasserie and Science Cafe and recorded by WFHB correspondents for Standing Room Only on WFHB.
Theme is food, and so today Dr. James Farmer is going to be talking about human perspective on local food systems, which we knew was going to be a great topic for Bloomington, of course, and we're glad you all can make it. I just want to mention that we are recording this event, so potentially in a few weeks when you're driving down the road listening to WFHB, you might get to hear it again on repeat. So be careful with your questions. No. We encourage an informal style of presentation, so feel free to raise your hand, stop the speaker, and ask questions as we go. The two other semester events that we have this fall are next month we're going to have a talk on food preferences and why certain foods are considered edible in some cultures and inedible in others. With Richard Wilk from the Anthropology Department, and then in November we're going to have Todd Royer from SPIA come and talk about the Gulf Dead Zone and how agricultural practices in the Midwest contribute to that and sort of the science behind it. And then in December we won't be having a Science Cafe event here, but there will be a microscopy art show that we'll be sending out more information about that will be at the Waldron Ivy Tech Art Center. So keep your eyes peeled for that. And also, if you're interested in joining the Science Cafe email list, because we do events year-round, not just during the semester, I'll have a clipboard at the end and sign up and give me your email address. We send out one announcement before every event just to let you know what's coming up. So without any further ado,
hi, my name is James Farmer. Thank you very much for having me. I'm pretty excited to be here and talk about the human dynamics of food. Originally, my title was a little bit different if you saw on the website, and I was like, well, that's really a boring title. So hopefully it's a little bit better. And I have to say, one time I was on the radio, and as soon as I heard my voice, I just had to shut it off. I was driving on my way to work. I was like, I cannot listen to myself on the radio, so just give me a heads up when that's playing, please. So I study local food, and as you can imagine, this is like the laughter time because my name Farmer, and people ask me, did you change your name? No, that's actually, you know, even though I come from coal miners and so forth, you know, that is my last name. And it was back in 2007, I'm on a road trip to Atlanta with my wife, and we checked out a new book, or a fairly new book, from the library to listen to Atlanta on the way there and back. And because I really hadn't thought about food, I'd always wanted to be a farmer. Specifically, I wanted to be a dairy farmer, but I think it's a lot easier being a college professor than a dairy farmer. But we checked out Omnivore's Dilemma, and I doubt that I'm the only person with this story, but I never really thought about food that way. And so that was like, you know, and so everybody's tired of hearing about Michael Pollan, but for me, that was the first thing that really sort of got me thinking about this and got my wife and I thinking about it, because she was pregnant. And we started thinking about, what are we going to feed our kids? And I never really thought, you know, I ate all sorts of garbage growing up. I mean, I spent a lot of time on Kirkwood as an undergrad. So, and this was La Bamba's, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I went to La Bamba's. And so, you know, but I never really thought about it until, you know, about 7 years ago. And it's led me down this track of doing research. And the data, the research that I'm going to present is It's a few years old now, but I think there's a lot of relevant ideas, and I want to first acknowledge the people that participated in this and helped either do the research or collect data or analyze data. There's a lot of people that gave ideas to the research design, but obviously study participants and CSA farmers and farmers markets that let us, you know, help us collect data. Student researchers from my undergrad research methods class at Marshall were helping on it, and then Michael Valiant, Sarah Menard, who's here, and all sorts of wonderful people that partook and gave me a lot of advice, because I'd never studied food before, and this was the first thing. And we were funded from the State Department of Ag, and Marshall helped out as well. So just to acknowledge those folks. And to give you an overview, first I just want to give you some sort of current trends and you know, what people are saying about the field this year, and then give you two brief slides on the methods. We'll get into the survey results, and then some other, I think, interesting observations and some take-home points. Feel free to slow me down, because sometimes I talk a little fast. But I was looking around when I was preparing for this talk, because I started reanalyzing the data, and I was looking around, and I wanted to see, okay, what are some of the hot topics? And I really found it interesting, from the National Restaurant Association, that, you know, the local everything is still so important. And now it's not just food, obviously, it's beer and wine and bourbon and moonshine, like over in Nawbonne, Indiana, with the new distillery. So everything local. And when you look at Forbes, at their food trends for 2014 and the NRA and what's hot, I mean, obviously local just peppers it, and there are other connections we can make here, like children's nutrition with the school farm, the school program. It's all over the place. And I have to say, instant ice cream surprised me. And I had to look it up to see what it was. And there's a place in San Francisco where they dump liquid nitrogen into the ice cream mix, and it evaporates at such a cool temperature, it turns it into ice cream. And I told my wife last night, I was like, we did that at the state fair like 10 years ago, because all the farmers bring these embryo tanks to the state fair, and we're in the milk fair, the dairy barn, and so we take ice cream, and then they, you know, pull out the embryos and dump nitrogen into the, yeah, and boom, you had ice cream. So I was like, wow, here in Indiana, we're actually on top of the food trends for once. Looking beyond this, and the USDA is a little bit behind in reporting on the census that was done in 2012, but these are some numbers looking at specific states and the percentage of sort of the local or direct marketing and distribution of food. Obviously, in New England and the East Coast, you see a fairly high proportion, but you know, it's growing everywhere. It's just continually growing, and this year, or the 2012 Ag Census for the first time, will really parse out local foods and farmers markets and CSAs, so we'll get a good look at that. The data was supposed to be out on May 2nd, and nobody can find it. Maybe I'm just not looking in the right places. And this is the current number of farmers markets. According to the USDA, Indiana's up to 171. I mean, California obviously is setting the curve there at 759. But the Midwest is actually, you know, doing pretty good, it seems like, in the Great Lakes area too. Here's a snapshot of Indiana, just to give you some perspective. When we did this research, when we collected data at farmers markets and CSAs in 2010, there were 134 farmers markets across the state. Now there's 179, according to other numbers. California, the low was in 1979 at 6. There was one farmers market in Southern California from the research that I've looked at, and now we're at 729 or so. So obviously, it's continuing to thrive. We are starting to see a little bit of a plateau, you know, thinking that maybe the farmers market world might be a little saturated on new markets. We see markets fail and new ones emerge. But it's still grown 471% in the last 20 years. It's fairly substantial. Now, current trends in CSAs. This group, I find a little bit more challenging to look at big national, or find information on national trends and data, partly because it's fairly new. We're looking at a phenomenon that started in the U.S. in 1986. There are similar ideas and notions and elsewhere in Japan that started earlier, as well as in Germany and other places. But we started out with two in 1986. By 2012, there were 6,500, according to Stephen McFadden, one of the major CSA sort of journalists and researchers. Today, he's estimating about 7,800. The USDA, I saw, they estimated over 12,000, but you know, I've not seen anybody else sort of report that number.
James, you should say what that is.
Yeah, thank you very much. Please stop and ask me to clarify. CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. Essentially, people, well, the farmers, you know, they have this program where people can subscribe to the farm, and an allotment of saying, making a commitment to the farm, you get an exchange of the farm's bounty, be it vegetables, fruit, dairy, meat, eggs, all sorts of other items. Some farms come together, like four farms, where for a few years, and I don't know if they still do, but there are four farms working together. You see that quite a bit. Generally speaking, the consumer, the shareholder, pays up front. Maybe it's February, maybe it's March, for food that they're going to get from June through October. So the shareholders are assuming some risk for the farm, knowing that you know you could have a hurricane or a tornado, or you know, you could have a drought like we did in 2012. And it could really decrease the amount of return that you get, you know, particularly on the investment. But it's really where the community is supporting the farmer and the agriculture that's going on. Thank you very much.
Here in Bloomington, I used the local Growers Guild guide over the past several years to look at the number of CSAs serving the Bloomington community. And the first time they show up in the guide is in 2007. I think the first guide that I could find was 2006. And so you see an increase and a peak in about 2012, and we've seen a little bit of a decline. CSAs are really challenging. They have over a 50% turnover rate from one year to the next. So it can be very hard to plan on that and to get people to stick with it over a long period of time. And we'll look at some figures a little bit later on.
I don't know how many of those are persistent. I mean, it's like
The CSA?
Yeah.
The names that I recognized over the, you know, I stopped last night and I was like, I should figure that out, but I didn't. So just going off the cuff, there's probably about half of them that exist today probably existed in 2010. I know my wife and I had one last year in grad school in summer of 2009. You know, ours was one that disappeared. So you just see them kind of come and go. And it might work for the farmers or maybe not. You know, but I have this one of Evening Song Farm. It's a farm in fairly the middle of Vermont. It was started by a couple of Earlham College graduates maybe 6-7 years ago, and the students lived on the Earlham School farm, and then they decided they wanted farms, so they moved out to the Vermont, and they pulled their money and borrowed from their parents, and they bought about 12-14 acres, and they were making a seriously great go at it, and I mean, just thriving, and had a great CSA, really hitting the farmer's market hard. And if you look online, you can see that they're really thriving today. But this is Hurricane Irene, and I'm sorry if you can't see it, but that's their main field. They have about 11 acres of tillable ground, and that's one of their greenhouses. The other one's already collapsed. This is what the river that bordered their property moved and took 7 of the 11 tillable acres away from the farm down to bedrock. So they no longer had the loamy, nice topsoil that they did. But in one night, this happened when Hurricane Irene went up the East Coast. But now they're, because they're part of a community-supported system, and people supported them, and they had supported the people with food, people provided land in the interim period for them to be able to keep the business going, to keep the farm going, to maintain a livelihood. And people really pitched in to help this farm out, which I think is just an amazing showcase of what community-supported agriculture is.
So did they have, do you know, did they have insurance to help with that?
They had like, you know, liability and that sort of insurance. And when I talked to them, when I met with them there, I brought them to Earlham College when I worked there to talk to and meet with the students. They were trying to get FEMA claims and FEMA insurance, but they had not had any success at that time. So I know, you know, a lot of people get donated money and so forth because, yeah, I mean, when 3/4 of your tillable acres is just, you know, vanished, and there's nothing
you can do with this.
I mean, it's not like you can bring in that much new topsoil because the river changed its course. So, good question. But that's what, you know, that's sort of the ideal CSA, you know, sort of example that I can give you. So the study that I'm looking at, that I'm talking about, it was a three-phase study, and there was a telephone interview section that we used to help inform the development of a questionnaire because we wanted to survey farmers market participants, CSA participants, and then people that didn't do either. because we wanted to be able to compare, because I've always been sort of like, you know, hammered in my research, because like, you don't have a non-participating group to compare to. So we actually did it this time. So we used the telephone interviews and a literature review to develop a survey, and then we followed that up with telephone interviews to gain more in-depth information. Now, today I'm only going to talk about phase two, the survey. And this map gives you some ideas of where we collected data. There are 12 randomly selected farmers markets from the 130 plus that existed. So we're down in New Albany and over at Richmond, Indiana. And I think that's, is that Marion? Marion, Indiana, and I know up in Goshen, Elkhart area, yeah. So we were, you know, Lafayette, Owen County, and actually Bloomington, fortunately, we're very happy that the Bloomington market got drawn because we wanted to collect data there. And then 17 CSAs from across the state as well. We ended up, and I'll give you the number for the participants there, but we ended up with 117 non-participants that filled out the questionnaire and sent it back.
You're listening to James Farmer and the Science Behind the Success of Local Food Systems on Standing Room Only. James Farmer has been explaining why local food systems work so well. Next, the speaker covers the data gathered from farmers markets on Standing Room Only.
So, on to the farmers markets, and I'm sorry if this is small, I'll hit the important parts. This is the demographic variables from age and the setting people live in, their education levels, their income levels, and their ethnicity. And these are what are the significant statistical differences, where there's a difference between those people that didn't participate and those people that are going to the farmer's market. The people that didn't participate, this is fairly, in quote, reflective of the Indiana census data. Now, in hindsight, that I've done more research and I know more, we should have probably had a different strategy for, seeking out our non-participants. But it is fairly reflective of the Indiana data. What I want to highlight, getting really high tech here, is the percentage of people without children that go to the farmer's market. Because I think if you have children and you go to a farmer's market, sometimes it can be a little bit challenging. I'm not going to lie. I got three kids, six and under. So if I'm by myself, it's really challenging. So there's a big proportion there that didn't have kids. And we tried to get around that, and we tried to get people, basically we're asking everybody that was coming, even getting close to us, it seems like, from what I remember. But we also gave people self-addressed stamped envelopes. They're like, hey, take this home. We know it's 95 degrees out. You don't want to fill out a 15-minute questionnaire. Take it home, bring it back to us, and mail it back to us. We'd love to have your data. If we look here at the education levels, it was a highly educated population. I think the number of people, or the percentage of people in Indiana with a bachelor's degree is somewhere in the mid-20 percentile, and where our farmers market participants were 62.2% of them had bachelor's degrees. That's not like the normal population. The median household income in Indiana the year we did this was about $49,000, where, as you can see, we're definitely on the higher end when it comes to income of participants. Ethnicity in Indiana in 2010 was about 83% Caucasian or white. So that gives you some perspective. Some noteworthy bits of information is the average farmers market person that we surveyed went 3.28 visits per month, which is pretty darn good. If you think about all the things going on in life, they spend almost $25. Just over 7% of them actually subscribed to a CSA, which is also fairly interesting. The vast majority of CSA subscribers go to the farmer's market. And 100% of the people who go to the farmer's market have a friend, a family member, somebody that goes to the farmer's market. So this is, they're really fitting into the social norm of their network. That's what these people do. We asked about how they learned about the farmer's market. Most of the people was through word of mouth, but also through positive newspaper stories, and there are some other things. But these are the two critical ones if you're on a farmer's market and something to think about. Now, in our questionnaire, we had a lot of different sections. And I think it was 4 pages total. The first page were there were 13 motive values. And try to understand, based upon the literature and the interviews and what people told us, try to understand from these sort of motivations or these values, you know, people's level and where they sort of rank them and where they place them. We had them fill out a Likert scale. We had statements about, you know, I desire to purchase food that's been produced in an environmentally sound and sustainable manner. And people scored, I strongly disagree with this statement, or I strongly agreed with it. And all of these were on that Likert scale. And so that gives you some idea of, you know, this first section. Then we asked about behaviors, how many dinners are you cooking at home? What were, you know, list the main ingredients of your last 2 dinners cooked at home, who does the food shopping, who does the food cooking, and so forth. We asked about, like, the second page were all the list of all the foods that you could get local in Indiana, just about. Even down as far as figs, which some people in the Louisville and New Albany area sell. Now I know that was actually a complete waste of space, and we should have asked other questions, because everybody said, like, tomatoes, cucumbers, sweet corn, cantaloupe. But, and then went on to ask people about how much money they spent at the market and their demographic variables and or questions and so forth. What I find interesting here, so I've added a group that I haven't mentioned yet. North Carolina farmers markets. Recently, we used this motive value scale and the demographic questions to analyze collect data at 3 farmers markets in the mountains of North Carolina to see how it would line up with these participants from Indiana. And if you see here, there's nothing, I didn't italicize or put stars or bold any of these, because there were absolutely no statistical difference in the motive values between the people at the 3 farmers markets in North Carolina, in and around the Boone area, versus the people in the 12 markets in Indiana. Some of them were to the 100th of a point identical, like on the desire to have nutritious food, which I found incredibly interesting, but it also, you know, sort of exemplifies the homogeneity in the motives of the people going to the farmers markets. If we compared it to the non-participants from Indiana, they're significantly and statistically different on values on every single one of these. Where cost of food, they found that, you know, they cited the cost of food at the farmer's market being more of an issue than obviously the people that go to the market. And on all of these, I believe, if memory serves me right, that they're all less. That, you know, so all these values, they don't value them as much, or at least they don't indicate that they do, than the people that completed our survey. So barriers that the non-participants did list was, first, nearly a quarter of them did not know where a farmer's market was. I'm like, okay, that's something we can do. We can deal with that. We can work on marketing campaigns and do signage in communities, but that's something we can work on here. Now, people that did not go to the farmer's market, by and large, live much further away, statistically significant distance, compared to people that do go to the farmer's market. Besides putting more markets in more places, I mean, that's a tough one to wrestle with. Saturday morning doesn't work for everyone. We had some open-ended questions in the survey, and Saturday morning, like, I got other things I'm doing on Saturday morning. My kids got soccer. I got to work, you know, all sorts of things. But most of the markets actually occur. The need for WIC or EBT capacity to perform the transactions or SNAP, believe it or not, there are farmers markets that they don't have the infrastructure for that. And so that's an area that we can remedy some economic challenges that might exist within certain populations. If, you know, people discuss public transportation, product costs, or lack of public transportation, the lack of variety of the products was a challenge for some people. They wanted to do the one-stop shopping, you know, depending upon time constraints. But and this is something I'll bring up later, is the cultural fit. people not culturally fitting at the market. They don't see themselves there. Maybe it's because of ethnicity or class or gender. It could be a lot of things, but culturally, think about all the factors that fall into culture, and if they don't feel like they fit there, it doesn't matter if they have the money, they're not going to go. So, and I think it's something that isn't really wrestled with very as much as it should be in the literature. Okay, this is where you all, the eyes are going to roll in the back of your head, and you're going to be like, okay, this wonderful statistical chart, and this looks awful. Sarah's the one that taught me how to do this, by the way, so blame it on her. So this is what's called regression analysis. Basically, I can put people into two categories and try to predict or try to identify which variables are really, really important. And so I've got the people in the non-participant category and the people in the go to the farmer's market category, and I threw in all these variables, all the motive values, demographics, and behavioral attributes, and I'm like, okay, I want to know what are the most important. And five variables were left after I did multiple iterations of this. And the five that were left was the motivation of organic food, motivation to get food that comes within 100 miles, education level or educational attainment, social connectedness, or I call social norms, and then proximity to the farmer's market. So what I find interesting is, one, this predicted whether or not an individual would go to the farmer's market, predicted it correctly 82.1% of the time. What these percentages are referring to is if somebody does not have a bachelor's degree, they're 83% less likely to go to a farmer's market. If they do have a friend or a relative or associate going to the farmer's market, they're 65.6% more likely to do it. For every mile they are away from the mean, which was what, 3.31, they're 6.7% less likely to go. As far as 4 miles, 5 miles, and so forth. Now, these that were the Likert scale, the strongly disagree to strongly agree, for every point on the scale you move, say you went from neutral to agree on organic, your desire to have organic food, you increase the likelihood of going to the market, this person, 72% of the time. So, does that make sense? These numbers just said, they told me this analysis met the statistical parameters that I should show it to you, there's some credence possibly here. So essentially, these factors, these five, amongst the participating farmers markets, were the most important. Now hold this thought. We're going to get back to it. We're going to jump over to the CSAs, and please stop me. So the CSAs, I didn't compare them to the non-participants right off the bat because they were so different. I thought it'd be more helpful to compare them to the farmers market participants. So when it comes to these demographic variables, you can see that the CSA subscribers were younger. More of them had kids in the household, at least that participated in our survey. More were living in suburban areas. The education I find really interesting. Over half of them had graduate level, master's, professional degrees. I mean, that's not normal amongst our population. It just isn't. When it comes to income level, 48.8% of them had a household income of $90,000 plus. One of the big factors in CSA is people pay the money up front, like February, for something you don't get till August. It's like, that's tough to do if you're not in a higher income bracket. CSAs, the new ones are developing with different models, and we'll talk about those at the end, but that's still a serious issue, and one of the major reasons for turnover. And in ethnicity, CSA subscribers were more white than the farmers market participants as well. So it gives you a perspective on the demographics. Now, when it came to the motive values, there weren't nearly as many differences between these two groups. Our CSA members wanted higher priority for environmentally sound food and the nutrition of the food. They wanted fewer chemicals on the food. That was more of an issue or a motive value for them. And access to whole foods, quite a bit higher actually on the emphasis they put on access to whole food. Sorry folks, behind that. Other important, I think, concepts or takeaway points from the CSAs is they also were the people that are cooking at home most. So, you know, oftentimes people say they get too much food in their CSA basket or box, and so
they're going to have something to do with it. The farmers markets were second, and then our non-participants third. We looked at marketing strategies. Honestly, family member, other word of mouth, friend or coworker, and even parts of the internet, Facebook. So that's sort of word of mouth in a lot of ways. I mean, that's how people learn about CSAs.
We will return in a moment to James Farmer and the science behind the success of local food systems. James Farmer has been explaining why local food systems work so well. We return now as Mr. Farmer gives an anecdote about the symbiosis of social media and local food here on Standing Room Only.
Real quick story out of Facebook. So, Facebook and CSA. We lived in Huntington, West Virginia. My wife and our first two kids and I. And there was not a CSA in the entire area. I think the closest one was Charleston, about an hour away. And we had a decent farmer's market. Huntington's a town of 40,000. It's got Marshall University. It's got a good hospital system. And we wanted a CSA. A lot of people have talked about it. And so my wife, this is all her, she went to the winter farmer's market meeting during the off season. And she gave a presentation because we knew what one was. We had one before. And she talked to the farmers. And one person stuck around after the meeting and said, okay, I want to hear more. So we went out to their farm and over in Chesapeake, Ohio, we talked to them. It's right over the river. We talked to them, we're like, this is what a CSA is. And they're really skeptical. They're like, should we get all the money? I'm like, yeah. They're like, no, we can't do that. You got to take the money, hold on to it, and then give it to us in increments. Like, whatever. I mean, like, you know, it doesn't matter. So at the time, we were going to a Presbyterian church, and in Huntington, it seemed like everybody went to church. We found out about it from an atheist friend who went to church. It was everybody went to church in Huntington. And so we said, we're going to share this with the people at church. In 1 week, 50 people subscribed to that CSA through the church Facebook page. And it was like, it really helped me understand, one, I should have bought stock in Facebook when it did their IPO, but two, just how important institutions and the social networks of institutions are. Because it just happened, it was like overnight 50. And so we're like, well, we tapped it out. And then the farmer said, well, we can do another 30. So they found another church, and they got another 30 people. And it was amazing what those institutions did to help that farmer. And we went back there to some of them still doing the CSA, and there's people still digging it. I think they were pretty skeptical at first. But eventually, they realized that this is okay. You know, we support you, and you supply food to us, and it worked. So the power of Facebook in that process, that's really where it hit home, and I realized it. Somebody asked about, I mentioned earlier, thinking about turnover of CSAs, the people that participated in the survey, 160 of them, or 58% of them, that was their first year doing it. And then it drops off dramatically. And that's kind of indicative of CSAs from the literature that I've looked at and what happens with CSAs. And so, I mean, that's such a challenging part, unless you have a very consistent and you have to do a really good job with it. Yes?
Have you compared that to other rates of entrepreneurship drop off in other industries? That if you have like restaurants or retail or other ventures that a casual investor might get interested in or involved in, and what their rates of drop off after the first year might be, is it comparable or different?
I've never thought about that, and that's why I like doing these things, so I can get these ideas. I think it's a great idea. I have no idea. I've not looked at that at all. No, but I think you got a lot of valid, that's a really valid point. Please.
So the way that you phrased that question to the participants, because there's a lot of turnover in just like the CSAs themselves. Like, so last year I subscribed to a CSA for 2 years and then they just stopped doing it, so I had to get a new one. Would I be considered like in the three category or the one category?
We asked people what year they first subscribed into they first started subscribing to their current CSA.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I feel like maybe the way you phrased that question, the fact that there's so much turnover in CSAs
It can inflate that. No, that's a great point. It's so funny how many things I've realized on this question asked. Why did we ask it that way? There's so many ways to improve it. No, that's a very good point. I want to go back and look at that.
So I apologize if I'm anticipating somewhere that you're going but just haven't gone yet. But you're really emphasizing marketing because word of mouth is like the huge variable here. But it strikes me that 3 of your 5 relevant variables are potentially related, and they're related on the point of class. And that's how close the people live to the farmer's market, how much education they have, and how much money they have, right? Like those are, or excuse me, and their social networks.
Yeah.
But those 3 are all intimately related. And so I'm curious if you're at some point going to emphasize the price, because it struck me that the thing that nobody, none of your respondents actually cared about, or they cared about the very, very least, less than half as much as everything else, was how expensive the thing is. But so how are you going to sell this to people who can't afford paying more?
And that is something I addressed at the end, and that's why I think it goes, you know, kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but I think it goes much further than just the economics. I think it deals with culture and class issues and privilege from a broader perspective of going beyond economics and thinking about race and gender and ethnicity and economics, but also education level and just sort of a multitude of variables that help you create a currency for an individual. As opposed to, I think it's just too simplistic to look at look at it as a money issue. You know, and we're just getting ready to start some work here in Bloomington, looking at people that use the Market Books program and also people that don't, and we're gonna also do some stratified sampling in different areas of Bloomington to look at, you know, interest and demand and sort of want for this type of food. So I think you hit the nail on the head. There are these other issues going on. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Now we ran that, you remember that slide I told you, like, hold that thought? You know, we ran it again for the CSA subscribers and the non-participants, and 6 variables worked out to say these are the most important. You think you'll notice the organic, the motive for organic, motive within 100 miles, but also whole foods emerged as a really important variable. Education, if you did not have a bachelor's degree, you're 88.5% less likely to subscribe to a CSA. Income, for each level you moved up in these categories, starting 0 to 30,000 and on up, your likelihood increased 173%. And then age, as you fell off the mean of 44 years for each year, your likelihood of subscribing went down by 4.6%. So, you know, it's pointing to a lot of different figures and ideas, but, you know, we're consistent on at least a couple of things. This organic, within 100 miles in education, at least between these 2 groups. It doesn't have to be, because we can deal with each of them individually. And it predicted this accurately 90.7% of the time, which, you know, I think it's fairly decent. And so, very, very high-tech models here, I know. But essentially, these are the variables, and I wanted to be able to visually just see what are those things really affecting the participation in these 2 venues. And again, that's the value for the local, the value for the organically grown, not certified organic, and then that educational attainment. Those were the things that came out. I think there's more to it than that, but that's just what emerged with this analysis. So in sort of getting towards some final thoughts, and this is, I think, where I'm going and thinking about this, and I want to do more work and more research and more analysis. That's what everybody says. We need to do more of it. But farmers markets and CSA subscribers from our study embody the demographics of a privileged professional class when compared to non-participant data and the Indiana census data. That, That's the people that we got data from, that's what it looks like. It doesn't have, you know, there's an economic component to it, and I don't think economics doesn't have to be a barrier. It's a barrier we can work on, like market bucks, like they have at the farmer's market, like the seniors, for seniors, the farmer's market promotion program, the voucher, SNAP benefits, WIC benefits. So if it's just straight up an economic issue, there are those opportunities, and there are others beyond that, but those are some ideas. For CSAs, some CSAs have working shares, where if you can't afford $700, you can work for, you know, for part, or somebody can do it for the full share over the course of the summer. They have pay-as-you-go models now, where you can split it up on three or four installments, or you can do a weekly installment, so you don't have to pay the $500 for a three-month CSA. So there are new models coming out that can help if it's just economics. But to me, I mean, I don't answer this question, but to me, it's sort of, this emerges, it's the cultural fit that's the issue. It's like looking at the big picture of culture in class. And I think it's more challenging. One, it's more challenging to come up with solutions to those sort of cultural barriers and to try to remedy that and work out the issues there. But I think that's something that we got to address. Moving on, it's the value for organically grown and local. These are factors that we can educate on. Yeah, we can educate people about, you know, the value of shopping locally. Now, there are economic issues with that, because oftentimes it is cheaper to buy, spinach that came from California. It can be cheaper. Depends on if you're buying in season. That's always the issue. Not everybody likes to eat in season. So when you're buying, we get nice tomatoes that are blooming to market earlier in the season, but they're probably, there's extra measures that have been gone into producing those. And so they can get a higher price. But I tell you what, right now, everybody's got tomatoes. You don't have to go to you just go to the neighbor's house. And so, it just depends on if you want to eat in season. Considering this data as well as the literature, farmers markets and CSAs are absolutely keystones in developing a local food system or redeveloping it. However, we're missing a lot of people, and so if we don't develop alternative mechanisms to reach the masses, then it might stay, catering a certain group of the population if we don't look at alternative strategies and how to deal with the issues that arise. And this isn't really about, it's just a certain group going. It's like, we're missing some people. So we need to learn more and figure out, what are the issues, and maybe we try every remedy we could possibly think of, and we're all working at the table together to come up with solutions, and it might still not work. And there might be alternative ideas that emerge from that sort of collective action and exploration. So that's the discussion and conclusion, but I have to say, I still have not answered why local. And so with this research, we're really looking at why do people participate in farmers markets and CSAs, and I'm working with Jennifer Robinson, who wrote the book to really showcase the Bloomington farmers market, and so we're working together on this, why local food, and it really, because it's really the bigger question to the study is why local food? Why are people doing it? Why are they engaging in it? And we started thinking about the fact that how people are migrating, particularly the people that are participating in the farmers market. They're not living in the hometown that they grew up in. Like, I don't live in Fountain City, Indiana anymore. I don't live in Richmond, Indiana, like the nearby city that you might have heard of. I live in Bloomington. Some of you came from the east or the west coast, and your family's not here, your grandparents aren't here, your cousins and so forth. And so it's this desire for community in some way. It is a desire for food, obviously, but it's a desire for community and the sort of building a replacement, if you will, an idea of a replacement cohort of people, a network. And so I'm wondering, and this isn't my answer, but this is my logic and what I'm going through and working with Jen and where we're considering this might go. There's also this distrust of the current industrialized food system. And this was an interesting graph that I saw that came out recently. But if we look at people's their trust in different food venues, I know you can't see there, but online grocers at the bottom, and it works its way up to big box retailers, national supermarkets, locally owned supermarkets, natural food markets, farmers markets. We get direct to consumer, farmer exchange. People have been asked those questions. How is my food grown? And so obviously there's that distrust for the larger system that we see people talking about.
But in the end, to me, it's like the farmer's market is kind of like Sunday supper, where you're like, you know, you go and you know people. You can't get through the farmer's market here in 15 minutes, not unless you get there at 7 a.m.
And you're just,
you gotta hit people up before they actually open. And so you gotta, there's no way to run through that market without running into people that you know. And so it's kind of like, you know, this network of rebuilding a community in a lot of ways, because you find this in different parts of different areas. And so in different parts of town, to make a big city small and reconnecting people with the people, the folks on the land, or the people setting up the urban farm. So that's sort of where my logic is going as I move forth in this particular line, thinking about what is it really providing that's changed in the United States in recent decades? Because we obviously are seeing major shifts of people to urban areas, and that's going to absolutely continue. So what's in it? Why is it local food? Why is it manifesting here? So thank you very much. And any questions you might have,
you're listening to James Farmer and the science behind the success of local food systems on Standing Room Only. James Farmer has been explaining why local food systems work so well. Next, the Q&A period starts on Standing Room Only.
Please. I have actually a couple of questions. One, have you looked at all at the supplier side of this, the growers? I mean, I started joining the farmer's market here when it was behind what's now the police station mid-70s, I guess. And at that point, the sellers were, you know, they were just kind of selling surplus. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, very local. We've got all sorts of very odd things. And, you know, over the years, that's about 35 years or so, clearly the suppliers have become much more sophisticated, professional, in a sense, you know, much more focused on the markets in terms of what they're producing. People who sell here also sell in Indianapolis and Louisville and other places. So, I mean, is that anything that you've addressed in your research, or is anybody else working on that? That's part of the equation, too.
Yeah, it's really important part of the equation. So it's interesting, you talk about the 70s, and you said sort of the weird...
Oh, you didn't know what was coming up.
So, well, in 1976, Congress passed a bill under the Ford administration that really promoted and allowed the sale of heirloom and seconds and sort of surplus at farmers markets. I guess there were some policies that had been put into place, I don't know if it was on a local or a national scale, that sort of infringed upon that distribution. So it was right about then the Bloomington market started and the one in Richmond, Indiana started. So several of our older markets actually started up right about then in the 70s. And to your question about what we're looking at, I've done some research with farmers in West Virginia, looking at basically interest in growing organically, but we also asked some marketing distribution questions, and by and large, most of the farms are really small out there. I mean, it doesn't really lend itself well to row cropping, and with the mountains and all, and we were looking at interest in organic certification, and it really came, I guess, you know, we are collecting data from farmers and taking a look at it. Specifically, Marcia Veldman, I'm working with Marcia Veldman and Sarah and the Monroe County Native Ministries and the Local Growers Guild, and we're going to be doing analysis and research here in Bloomington that's going to work with consumers as well as farmers to try not just to identify problems but come up with solutions, to see what farmers have an interest in doing, what the consumers want, and see if we can put some ideas together. So, you know, I think that's a smart way to move forth, and I think you're right spot on. Yes.
So one thing you didn't put into your analysis was competition. So I mean, in Wilmington we have Foods, and Star Market, where you know, soon have Whole Foods, and other places have the same population.
I think it's somewhat. Provides that those other places don't is like particularly this farmers market is recreation and I mean some people might recreate at a supermarket or at but I mean like most people don't. I don't know, I've not been to Whole Foods or Lucky's, I don't know, but farmers market, like when we, so the interview results, what was really interesting to me was that right up there with food and what was frequently discussed and like the common themes from the interviews was recreation and leisure. That was just had as much data as food did. I think it would be hard for something like that to compete and really draw down this market with 11,000 people on a Saturday morning because of the music and sort of the culture. If you have something else to add, please go.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a lot of people who don't go to the market because it's a social place and because they don't want to see a lot of people. So I think in terms of competition, having a market that's AAB, all about business, where you could maybe drive through like a pass and you order it up. I just think a lot of people don't have either, it goes back to culture, culturally food procurement is not a leisure activity, it's something to be done on the way to something else, or they don't want to see the people they know. I frequently don't go because I don't want to see people.
Sorry.
No, I think you're spot on. So I don't know how much it will affect the market there, but if you don't like that social atmosphere, it's a bad place to be.
Some days, like sometimes, yes, but sometimes.
Yes.
I was going to say, on both of those two notes, I've lived in so many different places around the country, and whether it was Brooklyn or Bloomington, the relationship that people had with their food was so complex. When you have these systems with so many different options, if it's your local food co-op, the big box store, the Whole Foods, the Sahara Market, whatever, thinking about, oh my God, I have so many things to do, cooking dinner and going to five different places is too much for a lot of people. Have you looked at the difference between large geographic centers and more rural populations and how that might create differences in how people utilize these types of services?
Yeah, I was just talking to someone this afternoon at the Ocean Workshop about how I need to, with the 12 farmers markets, we need to segregate the markets into big cities, like sort of smaller towns. To look at that very thing. I think that's an important issue. Absolutely. There's a hand back there, that guy in the Hoosier shirt.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the demographics of gardeners. I know some people grow a decent amount of vegetables, and that might hinder their time, or using their time to grow that kind of local food rather than go to a farmer's market.
I've not looked at the demographics of gardeners, but I can tell you that that's why I don't go, because we grow everything at home, and that's, I play with my kids on Saturday mornings, and we like, do a trash run, and we garden, maybe do recycling, and so, but no, I think that's, a lot of people, they might hit it on the bookends of the season, but if they really, if they're doing a lot of gardening and stuff, that might be why they don't go. I think it just depends on where you are, and sort of your location, because in Huntington, the government housing area, the government subsidized housing area, everybody had gardens. Everybody had gardens. I was amazed. I was like, what's going on here? And that was very normal there. I mean, in Huntington, just in general, and I don't know if it was an Appalachian thing being in the pseudo South, but like everybody had gardens. It was really impressive, and I couldn't find, I guess anecdotally, I didn't find any rhyme or reason to, different group, but, it seemed pretty darn common in there. So, I don't know, I can't answer your question, but I think it's an important one to think about, if we compare, data from around here to, garden, or farmer's market data around here to garden market, or garden data around here. Yes.
So the data that you looked at of the farmers markets and the CSAs, was there any one that was maybe an outlier where a certain variable was not what you expected to see, or maybe you know, that income was less, or you know, more people were going from a different kind of education background?
Like, can you paraphrase the question?
What's that?
Could the speaker paraphrase the question for the rest of us back here?
So the question, if I interpret this correctly, was did we look at like the individual CSAs and farmers markets to see if there are differences between them?
Yeah, was there any outlier in one of those markets, like at the very least?
You know, so did you all get that? So asking if there was any differences in like outliers within the CSAs that we looked at and the farmers markets we looked at. There was some different variation with the sort of the more, you know, I hate to use it, like, yeah, sort of the smaller post-industrial towns in Indiana. I mean, there's obviously a lot more demographic variation there, you know, compared to Bloomington or New Albany. You know, unfortunately, we didn't have enough, you know, questionnaires from every specific site to do some great analysis of in between sites. CSAs, I mean, the vast majority of them were in, you know, around the Bloomington area and around the Indianapolis area, just because there were so few CSAs then, comparatively. There were 54 then in the state, and you know, it was fairly homogenous in those two areas. And I think the system, or the pay up front and that sort of system that's often used, particularly in 2010, can also sort of select a certain group of the population.
Okay, yeah, so let's thank the speaker.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to James Farmer and the science behind the success of local food systems on Standing Room Only. On Tuesday, September 16th, Science Cafe presented James Farmer, an assistant professor in the SPIA School. Farmer is an expert in local food and the dynamics of farmers markets and restaurants. His presentation centered on the value of decentralized food distribution. This event was hosted by Finch's Brasserie and Science Cafe and recorded by WFHB correspondents for Standing Room Only on WFHB. Edited by David McGrail, with a special thanks to Marta Schockett from Science Cafe.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB. Executive producer is Allison Bektesh.